on average, you would expect an autonomy-supporting environment to be positive for motivation. It's based around a theory that's called self-determination theory. So, you know, we usually want to be autonomous. We want to be competent, feel competent, and we want to have feelings of social connectedness. And if all those come together, we're pretty intrinsically motivated. So, but I think in this case where you're saying, you know, could there be a case where somebody wants a bit of direction? Yes, absolutely. And maybe people who are depressed, where they're struggling to get up and do things, maybe that's where this direction, you know, within the bounds of being, you know, positive and supportive to them. But you could say, okay, this is what we're going to do, guys. Let's get to it. And I think that kind of direction, which is not very autonomous, could well work. I would like to think it would work early in the process when people are getting started. But as they progress, they become a little bit more autonomous. And I think that would help their intrinsic motivation. But that's just a, you know, bit of a guess on my part.
Yeah,
but I think because we're dealing with depressed people, I think that makes more sense than the general population.
Hello and welcome back to the Supporting Champions podcast. I'm Steve Ingham, and if this is your first time tuning in, then you're in for a treat. This is where we explore the often invisible aspects of achieving greatness and aspiring to perform, whether in sport, business, or life in general. We're not just about the headlines here. We're about the fine print, the strategies, the setbacks, and the comebacks that make the journey worthwhile. And we talk to experts from various fields, from coaches and scientists to leaders and, of course, performers. Those people who are out there trying. So it's not just about the performers. These are also about the people behind the scenes, the ones who are making champions what they are. This podcast isn't just for the elites or the top professionals. It's for anyone who believes in pushing their own boundaries, who believes in the power of progress over perfection. It's for anyone who's committed to improving, to learning, and to taking action. Whether you're a student, a professional, or someone simply interested in personal growth, there's something here for you. So if you're ready to dig deeper and apply some real-world insights to your own life, you're in the right place. The Supporting Champions podcast is sponsored by Athlete Now, a new venture I'm involved in. Now, Athlete Now is a new platform that's revolutionizing the connection between athletes and sports performance practitioners. We know that in the world of sports, the pursuit of peak performance is a constant journey, and it can often feel like a bit of a solo mission. And nowadays, with the high-tech landscape of wearables, nutrition, mental training, navigating your path to excellence might seem overwhelming. And Athlete Now aims to demystify this process, offering you straightforward guidance. So Athlete Now, or theathletenow.com, what's it all about? Well, if you're an athlete, then you know that the margin between good and great is influenced often by the expertise that's guiding you. But where can you find that expertise? Athlete Now offers the answer, granting you access to a curated selection of sports science, medicine, and coaching professionals. And they're not just qualified, but they're rigorously vetted so that you can search by experience, specialism, location, or accreditation to suit your needs. And Athlete Now is emerging as the solution for athletes seeking to push their limits and get the support they need. For the professional practitioners listening in, Athlete Now solves the age-old question, how do you stand out in a sea of talent? And the platform not only showcases your skills, but connects you directly with those who need them most. So whether you're a nutritionist whose strategies are fueling the champions, or a psychologist whose techniques are helping athletes to cope, strive, and perform, Athlete Now is your stage. For athletes, the platform is free, and for practitioners, you can sign up half price for this first year. Only £10 for the foundation tier, which will allow you to get your profile started, or upgrade for the professional tier, where you can get advanced features such as the jobs boards, community access, and practice guides. And that's just for £50 per year. So Athlete Now is more than just a directory. It's a community committed to excellence, ensuring athletes and sports professionals are perfectly paired to help support each other's ambitions together. So whether you're striving to compete or building a career, helping others do so, Athlete Now is really where it's at. So take a look at theathletenow.com. Welcome back to the Supporting Champions podcast. And in this episode, we're joined by Professor Stuart Biddle, a leading figure in the psychology of physical activity. And he's based at the University of Southern Queensland in Australia. Stuart's extensive work in exercise science and psychology provides groundbreaking insights into how exercise impacts our well-being. Our discussion today spans Stuart's illustrious career, from his early days contributing to the foundational layers of exercise science to his current work, which includes a significant focus on the mental health benefits of physical activity. And we delve into his latest collaborative research, which focuses new insights into the value of exercise as a potent intervention for depression, examining the effectiveness of various forms of physical activity and their impact on mental health, and comparing that with pharmacology and psychotherapy. As we get into the research and the implications, we inevitably go off in a few important tangents. Here are a few. What type of exercise is the most effective for depressive states? Is one type of exercise more beneficial for men versus women? Is moderate or intense exercise more effective? How do you coach people to start and sustain exercise? And importantly, how do you get children to eat more fruit and vegetables? Stuart's knowledge of this landscape is vast, but he is clear, conditional, nuanced, and specific. It's little wonder he advises bodies such as the World Health Organization on physical activity policy. But also listen in, as this episode is a digression from our more traditional focus on performance. But if you listen carefully, this discussion is littered with advice about how we encourage, coach, and make an impact on others. The cherry on top of the cake also is just the best quote about physical activity ever from the one and only Per Olof Astrand. Take a listen. Well, Stuart, welcome. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Yeah, and it's good to see you after a few years.
I'm so pleased that we've connected. I think the last time that we were interacting was on Twitter, having a small discussion about who the founder of sports science was, Craig Sharp or Clyde Williams and others. And you chimed in about the sort of 30th anniversaries of BASES. It's important for us all to connect over the years, isn't it?
Absolutely. And actually, to look back at some of the history, it's really quite interesting. I've taken a little bit of interest in that, particularly in the psychology area, but you could go beyond. And it is very interesting. And I think it's important for younger scientists coming through to know some of that stuff.
Yeah, interesting, isn't it? You were, correct me if I'm wrong, you were part of the team that added the E into BASES.
Yes.
The exercise, it was BASS before, British Association of Sports Sciences, and you had a squad that came along and graffitied an E in the middle, did you?
Yes, there was certainly a trend in let's say, sport psychology to become sport and exercise psychology. And although some subfields like biomechanics weren't particularly enthusiastic, I think we could persuade people that exercise was seen as a slightly different domain, and why not add it in and make it more complete and represent really what the field was about. So, that was an interesting exercise in itself, pardon the pun, and it seemed to work quite well, yeah.
So I'm sure you're too gracious and humble to recognise, but, you know, being able to be part of a team that put exercise science on the map is incredible. Perhaps that's a good chance, I mean, just to learn a little bit more about your background. For people that don't know, could you just give the listeners a bit of a potted history to you?
Yeah, of course, I started out in physical education because that was all you could study as an undergraduate back in the 1970s. And just as I was graduating, sports science type degrees were springing up. But then I did a master's in sports psychology and a PhD in psychology of sport, of course. and got into lecturing. And I've been as a lecturer, researcher, through to professor all of my career. And I kind of morphed from, doing not just psychology, but health and fitness and a bit of strength and conditioning. And then obviously focus more on psychology, particularly exercise and health. And then you could say my final part of my career broadened out to look at what I used to say was the bigger picture. So a lot of influences on why people might be physically active, why they might not be active. And that requires more than just psychology. I even had to learn a bit of physiology, dare I say, and epidemiology, and work with people who were looking at particular biomarkers in trials and things like that, where I was in charge of the behavior change element. So that was great. I really enjoyed that broadening out, looking at the bigger picture and becoming a bit more of a public health specialist rather than just a psychologist.
And that might touch on the complexities of why people do physical activity and the necessity to broaden. But did that initial sort of breadth, strength and conditioning and so on, did that help you later in your career? You know, that sort of initial start, perhaps more generalist, did that help you now?
I think it did. Now, you know, a lot of young people coming into the profession now want to specialize, and maybe universities and other institutions, not just universities, of course, want you to specialize and want you to be the expert. But I learned a lot by doing, first of all, teaching many different courses, and getting my hands dirty, so to speak, doing strength and conditioning and coaching. Personally, I think it did, because I could relate to some of the practical nuances and the practical realities of working in the field. Whether that works today, I don't know. I'd like to think people would get a little bit of broad experience.
I think it almost at recruitment, we're sort of probably culpable of looking for the specialists, the people dedicated in that lane, strength conditioning coaches from birth, nutritionists from birth, when actually that helps them perhaps in the initial stages of a career, but it doesn't help them when they're interacting with a multidisciplinary team. And their solution is not necessarily the solution. It has to be an amalgam of different options and different approaches.
I think mentioning that multidisciplinary team is key, and that is something we didn't do very well early in my career. I'm not even sure we used the term. We tended to be in our own little silos, and whilst that still happens, I think we've got a lot better at coming together and talking in these more diverse teams, and that's essential, of course.
Now, looking down your list of publications, I mean, you have to scroll. You have to ask Google Scholar to show more several times. It's a tour de force. But I reached out to you specifically about a paper that you're a co-author on. And it's really just an excuse just to pick your brain and just to tap into your knowledge base, really. But I can see that flavor of different approaches. There's one on here about family correlates of fruit and vegetables consumption. Maybe I'll pick your brains on that one too. But if I could start off with this particular paper, and just if I could ask you to help me understand and maybe unpack some of the bigger findings. So just to introduce it for people, and I'll put the link into the notes so people can go and have a look for themselves. First author, Michael Notell, is that right?
Yep. Yeah, he's local to here. He's at University of Queensland. I'm at University of Southern Queensland. So Mike is a terrific academic. And Mike had this idea to pull together, obviously, a number of studies. It's a systematic review, a meta-analysis. Well, let me just backtrack. So this is on exercise and depression. And exercise and depression, or depression, I should say, is probably one of the most studied areas within what you might call exercise psychology, because it was depression was probably the first outcome that people got interested in. Lots of studies out there, lots of systematic reviews, some better than others, of course. And it's been interesting because I hope I'm not sort of going off track.
No, no,
here,
no.
But, you know, there have been a number of quite big systematic reviews, quite high profile journals, British Medical Journal, which ours was in, but there was a British Medical Journal paper on the similar topic 20 years ago. And they get criticized because the quality of the individual studies that goes into the meta-analysis is usually quite low. It's not to say they're bad studies. It's just quite difficult to control for a lot of factors in these studies. And so you might get a strong effect. Exercise is, you know, if it's in a trial context, produces quite strong effects in changing depression, but the studies get rated at what we call higher risk of bias or lower quality of study. And so if you're a little bit hard-nosed, you would say, well, you know, it's a big effect size, but it doesn't really matter because they're all weak studies or they've got high risk of bias. So your confidence in drawing conclusions is diminished. Mm. Okay, fair enough. But, you know, sometimes we judge these studies by standards that are not always possible when you're doing field-based exercise studies. So they may not be quite as biased or weak as sometimes we think. Anyway, let's come back to the topic. So depression has a long history in this field, and there's still stuff coming out. And what we tried to do in this study was also to look, particularly to look at not just did exercise affect depression. I think we pretty much know that. The findings are pretty robust, despite a few skeptics out there. But to say, well, are there different activities that might have more beneficial effect than others? And I have to admit, I've never really bought into that in the past because I think it can be quite individual. You might say you love swimming. I might say I don't like swimming. So where are your mental health benefits going to come from if I don't like swimming? It's going to be a bit of drudgery. I might get something, but it might not be as good as if I was to say, well, I love walking, and you might say, oh, I'm bored by walking, I like to do something else. So it kind of horses for courses. And that was my belief anyway, that, you know, I wasn't convinced we were going to get much in the way of results, but we did. And, you can look at certain activities. Of course, some don't have many studies. That's the problem. I mean, dance type activities actually came out quite strongly in our review, but the number of studies and the number of robust studies wasn't particularly high. So you've got to be pretty cautious. Mm. But just anyway, that was the general gist.
Does that approach that you've thought about leading into this area, is that informed by as much adherence, uptake, do what you enjoy? Approach.
Yes, exactly.
And I think that the as a physiologist, I'm asked, what's the best exercise? I've heard triathlons are great. Heard swimming's all round body exercise. Yeah. I heard running's good for your bones. And so there's this sort of there's an attempt to rank and rate the different types of exercise. And I was struck by an executive I was working with, and I was talking about cross training and walking and all these sort of things. She said, you know what? I used to dance. I used to really dance well. And I was like, do that then, if that's what you love. She said, I would absolutely love it. And that sense of enjoyment, either in anticipation, during the social connections and afterwards, it just struck me as the ideal solution. And from ever ever since then, I've had that type of conversation. People have asked me, and I say, well, what do you enjoy? What have you done before? So that there's more of a fertile ground that people can build a habit on.
So, I mean, you're absolutely right. And we can look at this from way back it was sort of thinking, well, exercise is exercise. Physical activity is physical activity. That will produce depression reduction, positive depression effects. And then it's a matter of, well, how hard should the exercise be? How long should it be? Well, all that is important, and does it have to improve your fitness, or can you just be physically active without necessarily shifting your fitness levels too much? All that's important. But when it comes down to it, it's what you've just said. I think there's a much stronger interplay between the biology of energy expenditure, and I think energy expenditure is really important here, with the sort of psychosocial. So if dance, for example, comes out as generally a pretty positive form of physical activity, notwithstanding the fact there were rather few studies and few high-quality studies, why is that? Well, it is probably a strong psychosocial element. Maybe the music comes into it as well, but it's quite different from somebody going out running on their own without any, let's say, music, just running. Now, some people are going to love that. We've known from the past, we've been associated with runners who are just lap it up, but others will find that much more difficult, and therefore the mental health effects won't be quite so obvious. So, as I say, it's going to be horses for courses. It's going to be very much individualized. But, there are some trends. There's certain activities that seem to maybe boost and enable the mental health benefits at the same time.
Yeah, interesting. And so the title of the work, Effective Exercise for Depression, Systematic Review and Network Meta-Analysis of Randomized Control Trials. So you've got a good squad of authors who've collaborated on this study. Maybe you've answered this question, but what's the problem that the paper is trying to resolve? Is it finding clarity amongst a myriad of interventions?
Yeah, there's definitely that. I mean, there are a lot of reviews out there, as I've said, a lot of meta-analyses. So what's ours adding? Well, first of all, you're updating. It's the most up-to-date. It's on trials, randomized controlled trials, so-called gold standard of research design. We're also trying to look at interconnectedness between types of activities and types of studies and seeing whether they hold together. That's the network part of it. So there are a number of things. Probably the most, well, at least to those who are reading it from a relatively lay perspective or non-specialist perspective, is to say, well, are there clusters of activities, types of activities that might have better mental health effects or anti-depression effects than others? Let me just highlight one interesting one, and it is an interest of mine that's been in the last few years. So sort of yoga and those kind of activities, which are interesting because they came out quite well. Some would say, oh, yoga, it's not really that vigorous. You don't sort of get fit doing yoga. Well, that's debatable. There are some yoga poses that are extremely demanding. Mm-hmm. But yes, it's a relatively calm, it's basically around poses rather than vigorous activity. We know that. But it does also integrate a little bit of mind-body functioning, doesn't it? So parts of a yoga session, if people listening to this are not so familiar, will include some relaxation, some breathing, some thought processes, deliberate thought processes. And, maybe that's creating the antidepressant effect and not just the physical movement. So we have this I wouldn't say it's a dilemma, but we have this issue that, you know, what is it that's causing antidepressant effects? And to what extent is it the physical movement? And to what extent is it is it something else? I mean, could you get the same effects, for example, playing chess? Or could you get the same effects reading a book? Well, yes, you could. So it's not just the physical movement. On the other hand, physical movement can be extremely beneficial and can have its own effects, you know, in their own right.
Right, so a combination of not just necessarily the physical activity, but what it requires of you, what it prompts you to do, what it's maybe it also stops you from doing. As you allude to, the dance, unless you're boogieing in your living room on your own, maybe just dance on the Wii or something, assume that's going to be, you're going to be dancing with people, the Zumba type effect that, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, you make a similar sort of connection between walking, and so perhaps the supplementary effect of being in nature, assuming you're not going to be in a garage on a treadmill, that there is an additional component of that. We need to sort of try and hatch something where you're doing a walk dance in nature with the opportunity to stop and pose. It's an amalgam there.
I mean, but you've hit the nail on the head in the sense, okay, so we just go back to this idea of enjoyment, and you know, you get mental health benefits because you're involved with an activity you're enjoying. I might say a bit more about that in a minute, depending where we go. But my question is, what is it you're enjoying? And it might be the music, it might be the social, it might be some skill element. I mean, I like to play a bit of golf, and it's probably a bit of all of those. You're out in nature. I'm with some friends. We have a good social rapport. It's a skill challenge, and that kind of is interesting. So, whereas my yoga, and I do go to yoga classes. Maybe it's a bit of that. It's less the social for me in yoga, and more to do with the physical and mental integration. So all I'm saying is yes, we want to enjoy it, but what is it you're enjoying? I can walk from the house. I'm in my house now. I can walk from my house. I live in an area which has some person-made lakes. They're great. They're very attractive, and they're just about the right distance for me to walk. Now, would I do the same if it was just around a bunch of houses or more commercial area? Probably not. But I love this walk around the lake. So again, the nature element. So what is it that drives us? What is it that reinforces us? And what makes us come back? And then the mental health effects of just the exercise, but also the exercise plus. That's what we're probably after.
That makes me recall a conversation with Kostas Karagiorgis on the on the podcast. And one of the components that he referred to was sort of the hedonistic effect of how you leave an exercise session, whether an exercise class, the hedonism of that, and how music can facilitate the memory that you leave the exercise with, as opposed to necessarily what happens during. It's how you remember it, how it finishes, that he was particularly interested in. And that seems to connect a little bit there, what you're saying, that what's the enjoyment aspect, as opposed to what are the physical manifestations, whether that is bone health or blood pressure reduction later in the day, or dopamine, whatever it might be.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, Costa's done some great work on this with music and sport and exercise. And we also know, by the way, that a lot of the you can pretty much be guaranteed that when somebody finishes an exercise session of whatever type, their positive feelings, their feeling states increase. You know, so post-exercise, we do have that feel-good effect. You may not necessarily have that during exercise. That very much depends what you do. For example, if you do something particularly strenuous, it might be quite tough. you still might feel good at the end, but just for a bit in the middle, you might be having some, you know, challenges. So, yeah, I think this might relate to what Kostas is saying, and the post-exercise rise in positive affect. It's quite important. Yeah.
And so the big findings, if I'm not mistaken, that exercise interventions are comparable to psychotherapy, and exercise is stronger than pharmacology as an intervention for depression.
Yeah, this is, I mean, some people think, whoa, that's a bit strong, isn't it? But actually, that's been found in the past as well. And people have, now, for very severe forms of depression, you know, we're not saying forget medication, just go for a run. That would be irresponsible. Medication is very important for some people, particularly at the higher end of levels of depression. But for those with more mild forms of depression, it can either be an adjunct, so the two can go together, psychotherapy and pharmacological interventions alongside physical activity and exercise, and in some cases just exercise. And again, if I just digress slightly, so back in my days at Loughborough, I had a fantastic PhD student in Guy Faulkner, and Guy is now a senior professor in Canada, University of British Columbia. Excellent track record in a number of areas of physical activity. But he had an initial interest in mental health, and he did a very interesting study where he interviewed directors of clinical psychology programs in the UK, clinical psychology training programs, and asked them about the role of exercise in mental health. And he got quite sort of skeptical come, I'm not quite sure what the word is, but they were saying, you know, it needs more than exercise. You can't just cure somebody of depression just by asking them to go for a run. It's and now there was a bit of self-serving bias in there, I think, that the directors had to justify their role as clinical psychologists, and maybe that's being a bit unkind, but you know, we've never said it's just exercise, but it can sit alongside psychotherapy, and some people call it exercise is psychotherapy. And it can sit alongside the more you know, drug based interventions. So it's actually not such a surprising finding from our meta analysis, because it has been found in the past. It comes out very well against these alternatives, which of course, from a cost effectiveness point of view, is really important, because exercise is usually pretty cost effective.
So there's something that's occurring to me here. And it is something I encounter in some conversations with people. And I'm talking about types of exercise that they might want to take up for fitness purposes. But increasingly for people, perhaps even like elite coaches, who are actually surrounded by this high-intensity environment, but also extensive training programs, and then neglecting their health. And again, they veer to what should I do? When actually the solution might not necessarily be the weight loss intervention or the structured running program. It might actually be something that helps their mental health generally, perhaps not from a depressive end of the continuum, but certainly helping them cope and manage. And I've had a similar response to suggestions to go for a walk. and it almost feels like it belittles the suggestion of, you know, when you know, there's a sentence in the study about, you know, we hypothesize that a combination of social interaction, mindfulness, experiential acceptance, increased self-efficacy, immersion in green spaces, neurobiological mechanisms, and acute positive effect combined to generate outcomes. But if you just wrap it up with, just go for a walk, mate,
That's right.
It sort of it makes them go, is that it? Is that the whole
That was the reflection from those clinical psychology directors. That was, I was struggling to find the words to explain it, but that's exactly right. Yeah, it's too simple, right? And it belittles it. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
So I'm gonna try and record that sentence from the study, and I'm gonna try and replay that. And if I'm thinking about social interaction, connection with nature, neurobiological, my best suggestion is to perambulate in nature or something like that. I'm going to try and sort of dress it up so it doesn't just sound like just go for some strides.
of course, what it does tell us is it is multifaceted, and actually, you were saying earlier that. Getting out in nature, for example, is a great way to get the benefits of both physical activity and mental health. I actually, when I was working at Loughborough, my house had I put a treadmill in the back of the garage, and it was a low ceiling. It was a bit dark. It was a pretty grotty area. And I used to go on the treadmill, and maybe because I had different motives, I had some music on for sure, and that to me was sufficient, given the limitations of where I was, to get some mental health and physical benefits. So it very much depends on the individual, but it's multifaceted. So yeah, you could do green space, you could do social stuff, you could do mind body, whatever. But you don't have to do them all at once, and you take what works for you, basically.
And so you're looking at effect sizes. You mentioned that dance came out well, and walking and jogging. But what's interesting that, and you couch this in the paper nicely, but I'd love to get your interpretation. Strength training seemed to be slightly more effective for depression for women, and yoga and qigong type exercises more effective for men. That was an interesting, almost perhaps maybe counterintuitive to the stereotypes that we parrot. What's your sense there?
You're absolutely right, and I'm not sure I've got a very clear answer to that. I do think, by the way, that strength training, and we know that, whatever we want to call it, strength training, muscle strength exercise, resistance exercise, all that stuff has become much more in the public eye for public health. It's more prominent, it's more in national guidelines now, and so on. Now, what's that got to do with your question about, gender differences? I don't know. I honestly don't know. Maybe more women now are doing that stuff and getting more benefit. I don't know. But, I think it's going to be a more prominent form of exercise than it has been in the past. And I know from my own personal experience, this is a terrible sort of just an anecdote, N of one, I used to get very positive and quite rapid feel-good effects from muscle strengthening exercise. There's very much a physical feedback about muscles contracting, and you can feel the muscles working and so on. And when you finish that, there's a great sense of satisfaction. So maybe it's that. But no, the gender or the sex differences, I can't honestly explain very, very clearly. And that, therefore, that's something we must continue to look at. Interesting one. The yoga and the Tai Chi may be the opposite, that men, have never, well, not the opposite, actually, it's a similar issue, that the men are generally underrepresented in those groups.
Right.
Maybe you're getting a certain type of individual who goes to those sessions. I don't know. They're plausible, but they're things we have to look at.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's not for me to freestyle on it, but it just struck me as that sort of counterintuitive of it. It's almost that sort of questioning of about wondering what's missing physiologically or what's dampened physiologically in depressive states, but actually the strength training from a, say, anabolic hormones point of view, boosting some of those areas, when actually the yoga and Tai Chi and others might be sort of calming some of that. It was just interesting as a finding that it wasn't necessarily consistent. It was actually polar and opposite.
Yeah. And, you know, you do get this in some of these studies, and you're trying to pull together not that large a number of studies, some of which are stronger than others, et cetera, et cetera, and diverse samples. So these are trends. These are interesting trends, but they are, I'm not sure we're at a point where we can fully explain them. And, you know, that it's a trigger for somebody to come along and say, right, here, there's an interesting point. Let's go and have a look at that in a bit more detail, see if we can progress our understanding of, in this case, sex differences. So, yeah, it's an interesting one. And I'm not sure I can fully explain them myself, which, of course, is, you know, normal in academia. You can't fully explain all your results, and you have to move on and try to progress it from there.
Well, let me try another one if I can from the paper. But but the vigorous exercise seemed to perform a little bit better.
And
what occurred to me when I was reading that was just that sense of and do excuse me and tell me off if I've phrased this wrong, because you should. Is there a risk that perhaps depressive states would lead to less willingness to engage in something that requires high motivation, perhaps as opposed to a walk, which is a low barrier to entry, there's low friction there. But, right, you're doing a high-intensity interval session on a bike, in a class that's going to require you to get up for it.
You're not saying anything stupid at all. In fact, you've absolutely hit a very important point, and exactly that people who are depressed will find it difficult to do these, or difficult to get started to do these things. That's part of being depressed. So now maybe that introduces a bias into some of these studies, that these studies are the ones that we've recruited people into, and they've been not cajoled, but you know what I mean. You know, they've been encouraged, shown willingness to be there.
Are you up for it?
Exactly. Yeah, okay. Yeah, so right. You've got a certain type of person, they react positively to that. I would say though, so just on that point, you know, so if you can get them in the sessions, you normally have some pretty positive effects. But yes, the challenge is, can we get them into the sessions in the first place? And that is a behavioral challenge that we still have in this area. By the way, something quickly comes into my head is, I did hear a lecture by a forensic psychologist working at the Rampton Hospital, not too far from, well, in the Midlands, in the UK, high secure, very demanding patients, and they had great success in a number of changes to health behaviors in terms of diet, smoking, physical activity, and so on. And these are not just depressed individuals. They have a number of quite challenging psychological conditions, but they managed to get them involved. And I won't go through, well, I probably don't understand all what they did, but from what I gathered, they had some a lot of success in getting those behavior change to occur. So it can be done, but yes, it's challenging to get depressed people, you know, to put a foot out of the door, as they say.
Mm.
So, you know, I think that's a really, really important point. If I can come back to the issue of intensity, it doesn't surprise me that slightly higher levels of intensity stimulate more than lower levels of intensity. I mean, they do physiologically, obviously. And I think psychologically they can do up to a point. I've been a bit unpopular amongst certain groups of researchers who are big into high intensity.
It's your thoughts and opinions that might stir the pot.
Okay, maybe that's a good way of putting it. But you know, I said that HIIT type training sessions were not relevant for public health. I just didn't think enough people would do them. That's all I'm saying. They're tough, and would we get people to adhere to them over a long period of time? And people didn't like me saying that because HIIT was flavor of the month and so on and so forth. But what I'm saying is that, we do know that high levels of intensity can be challenging, and during exercise can produce actually negative psychological states, but afterwards can produce positive psychological states. So it's a matter of whether people are willing to put up with the negative and the challenge to get the reward at the end. And now it depends on the level of intensity, of course. Some people will do a little bit more than before, and it's not really that intense, but it's a bit more, and get a lot of positives out of that. So that's probably what we're finding with those results is, people are liking the challenge a bit and they're feeling that they've got through this challenge and they feel good about that. And of course, they're probably improving their fitness a bit more and that makes you feel good. So why wouldn't slightly higher intensity, as I say, up to a point, have that benefit?
So that's the way I see it. It's got my programming mind going in the sense that if I was to suggest to an athlete that they needed to address a certain component of their physiology, and what I wouldn't necessarily do is suggest to a coach, let's supplement this interval set at a certain intensity. We wouldn't supplement that in. We wouldn't sort of chop something out from a program to make space for it. I would try and get them to grow that session up. So that could be rather than say, a Thursday 1 hour run, that it's a Thursday 1 hour run with 5 minutes at a slightly elevated pace. The following week it's two lots of 5 minutes and it's growing that up. And it was almost just occurring to me that if you got them in to do an exercise session, you could sneak an interval in and then the following week you could sneak another one. But ultimately that's how we would rehab an injury as well. That's how we would progress a certain fitness component. And I'm just curious as to whether any of these exercise interventions have taken a progressive overload where you're actually trying to not only grow the volume, but grow the blend of intensities that people are using.
I don't know is the simple answer, but what you just said makes a lot of sense. But I think what we do know from just to simplify the relationship between exercise intensity and affective response is at those very high levels is generally negative. People find it unpleasant. Not forever, because when they finish, they get that rebound effect. And they feel good, but so the key point is here. I think for exercise adherence, we think it's best predicted by how you feel during exercise.
Right.
So if you feel pretty, you don't feel great during the exercise, it's too hard, that's probably going to predict a lack of adherence. Doesn't matter how good physiologically it is for you, that's probably what's going to happen. So it's this kind of roundabout way of addressing what you're saying. And that's that was my argument against some of the HIIT claims about it being the best thing since sliced bread. Well, nobody's actually said that, but that they were claiming this was a wonderful thing for everybody, and I was saying, well, hang on a minute, some people are going to find it too tough and therefore not like it and therefore drop out, and that was the argument.
It does make me wonder whether you from a physiological point of view you could you could get the intensity, but without the distress. There's ways in which you could potentially do that, with short bursts that demand intensity and blood flow and heart to work hard, but not accumulation of metabolic end products. But
Well, that's an interesting one. I wonder whether that's somewhat similar to exercise breaks. And for example, if I walk into the building where I'm work at the university and walk up the stairs to the third level, it's quite demanding. They're quite steep stairs and it's quite high. It only takes me 30, 45 seconds, something like that. People say, oh, I bet it's take, you know, that's a 5-minute workout. And well, no, it's not. It's about 30 seconds.
It feels like 5 minutes. That's the
But it is quite vigorous. It is quite vigorous. Now, then the issue is, well, how often would I have to do it? Breaking up my day, is that good? Is it bad? Anyway, so yeah, these kind of things need to be looked at. And the whole area of exercise breaks is an interesting one. And that's certainly possible.
Now, another comment in here around autonomy was interesting. And I'm wondering whether there's some applicability here for coaches or physical education teachers who might have a range of people who are highly motivated through to not that bothered, through to actually I'm not that well in their class, but also in their sports-based group. So my understanding is that offering choices, invitational language, sort of here's your options, you choose, that actually weakened the effects on depression when actually a little bit more direction of do this, don't have to think about it, seemed to actually strengthen them. Is that right?
So that is counterintuitive to, well, yes and no, it's counterintuitive. So let me say a couple of things on this. So one is that on average, you would expect an autonomy-supporting environment to be positive for motivation. It's based around a theory that's called self-determination theory. So, you know, we usually want to be autonomous. We want to be competent, feel competent, and we want to have feelings of social connectedness. And if all those come together, we're pretty intrinsically motivated. So, but I think in this case where you're saying, you know, could there be a case where somebody wants a bit of direction? Yes, absolutely. And maybe people who are depressed, where they're struggling to get up and do things, maybe that's where this direction, you know, within the bounds of being, you know, positive and supportive to them. But you could say, okay, this is what we're going to do, guys. Let's get to it. And I think that kind of direction, which is not very autonomous, could well work. I would like to think it would work early in the process when people are getting started. But as they progress, they become a little bit more autonomous. And I think that would help their intrinsic motivation. But that's just a bit of a guess on my part.
Yeah,
but I think because we're dealing with depressed people, I think that makes more sense than the general population.
So lead people to start off with rather than, hey, it's up to you. It's a free space for you to fill. Well, actually, that might require adding to decision-making load or I don't know because I don't know myself or I'm uncertain.
Absolutely right. And I've had this in the past where, you know, somebody, you think you're doing them a favor by giving them lots of choices, but actually they come back to you and say, sorry, I'm a bit overwhelmed by all this. I don't really know what to do. Can you just tell me? Can you just, or at least steer me towards something? And then they pick it up from there. It's interesting. It's not a million miles away from some of the motivational elements of starting an exercise program versus continuing it or maintenance of exercise. We're very bad at understanding maintenance, actually. And years excuse me, years ago, somebody said, you know, we're likely to start doing exercise for reasons of health. So it's quite sort of instrumental and it's quite directive. You know, I'm going to do this to lose weight. I'm going to do this to, you know, reduce my heart disease risk or whatever. But once they get going in exercise, it tends to be much more affective and driven by enjoyment, as we spoke about earlier. And maybe that's not too dissimilar to what we're saying about, you know, being quite directive early on, and then they become a bit more autonomous as they go through and look to maintain involvement. Just a thought.
Is there a requirement there to transition from a state of thinking about I'm exercising, I'm trying to exercise, there's an effortful sort of statement there, through to I'm an exerciser and being part of someone's identity, as opposed to something they're forced to do, as opposed to maybe like a rule. It's part of me, and so I do this.
Yes, absolutely right. You know what, Steve? You've missed your calling in life. You should have been a psychologist.
We should have been a strength coach, Stuart.
We should have gone that way. But that's a great point. And I think exercise identity, or, you know, identity as a physically active person is absolutely right. And you identify with it. And that's also part of this theory, this self-determination theory. You take in and you digest that kind of philosophy, and that's part of you, rather than being told to do something and you feel guilty if you don't. You've not really taken on board that. Whereas if you take it on board and you say, yeah, this is me, I'm an exerciser, I identify in that way, and I want to do it, not that I have to do it. This have versus want is really important. And it's true in lots of areas of life. You know, I want to do it rather than I have to do it. If you can get that transition to the want, you're more than halfway there.
Mm.
Yeah.
So are the guidelines of 150 to 300 minutes of moderate activity, 75 to 150 of vigorous activity, are they overly intimidating to start? I mean, that's a sudden increase. That would feel quite overwhelming for people.
Say it is.
If you're starting out, here's how to, you know, maybe consistency is more important than volume in that sense.
Yeah. So first of all, I mean, this is really interesting. I'm right in the thick of guideline work right now. The Australians are updating their adult and older adult guidelines for physical activity and sedentary behaviour. And I'm looking at a file right on my desk here, full of all sorts of stuff I need to do. I was also involved with the WHO guidelines. And, you know, these are essentially health-related guidelines. This is what you need to do to optimize your health. It has, they were not written to say, how can we get more people to be physically active?
Okay.
Although, obviously, we want to get there eventually. So going back to your point about, you know, is it too intimidating? Is it too much to get started? Absolutely could be the case for a lot of people. To be fair, WHO and a lot of other guidelines have that little caveat in there that says, you know, start small, build up, anything is better than nothing, all of that kind of stuff. And so even if you don't get anywhere near 150 to 300, if you're doing something and you're doing more than you were doing before, you're making progress.
Mm.
And that's the kind of balancing act that guidelines people have. You know, governments want clear guidelines. They want numbers. They want minutes. But we know that the reality is that there's a lot more to it than that.
Hmm.
So guidelines are interesting from that point of view.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. That just doesn't seep out into the ether as much, that something is better than nothing, because that is a very powerful statement. Yeah. Something a little bit every day, that feels a bit like, to draw a crass parallel, the 10,000 hours versus, I'd probably frame this, if you wanted to market your piano learning lessons or learning a language, you'd say, follow my course, it's 5 minutes a day. Yes. Rather than you've got to do 10,000 hours yes. and it make people go, oh, you know what, I'm not going to bother because that so feels true. Insurmountable. Take so the first true. Few steps up the mountain rather than look at the peak.
Yeah. So true. Yeah, yeah. And to be fair, again, to guidelines, it's about optimizing health at a public health level. And later on, guidelines get disseminated and cascaded down to different groups who then try to apply it to behavior change and to different target groups and so on. And they may change the actual numbers. They may take the sort of more is better approach rather than 150 to 300 minutes. But yeah, it's an interesting conversation, I think, of always around guidelines. Yeah.
So we're probably talking a lot about poking and prodding and motivating and cajoling mm-hmm. and inspiring people to do activity. But at least on the first page of your reference list is this article about fruit and veg consumption. I'll ask you before you go. And so I haven't delved into the paper, but the headline, it seems as though a child's fruit and veg consumption is related to the adults from a role modeling point of view. Discuss, and please can expand if there's a similar thing around physical activity.
Mm. You put me slightly on the spot because I haven't seen that paper in a long time, and it was beautifully led by my Loughborough colleague Natalie Pearson. But so first of all, we've always been interested in health behaviors and health behavior change. We've done 99% of our work in, or not 90% of our work in physical activity, but there are these other behaviors that are equally interesting, diet, of course, being one. And as far as the sort of healthy diet's concerned, there's a key, key component is to try to shift fruit and vegetable consumption, just as one component, of course. And yeah, I think so. What you tend to find, and this is true to a certain extent of sedentary behaviors and physically active behaviors, is the modeling effect and the social contagion effect of, in this case, parents with children. And don't forget, in terms of diet, parents basically provide the diet, right? Mm. Certainly in the home.
Yeah.
Yeah, they do the shopping, they do the cooking. So what are they going to eat? They're going to eat what their parents prepare for them. And I used to find with my children, again, sorry, anecdote N of one, if I cut up the fruit, they would eat it. But if I gave them a bit of fruit that required cutting up, oh, it's too much effort. So, making it available, making it palatable, cutting it up, obviously, they got to like the type of fruit that you or vegetable that you're providing. So, the same determinants of dietary patterns can be found in physical activity, providing the right social environment, the right physical environment, providing the right conversation, if you like, around behavior change and so on. So, yeah, I find that kind of interesting. I haven't done a lot of work in that area, to be honest, but it is pretty interesting.
I have a memory of Neil Armstrong, and for people who are listening, this is the pediatric yes, physiologist,
not the astronaut,
not the as I'm sure he's pained to explain yes. throughout his life. Yes. Putting an overhead up at a Basie's workshop in, it must have been 1998, about physical activity, and he put a correlation between body composition of the pet dog and the owner. And I've asked Neil since, and I've asked Craig Williams, and they don't remember it, but I remember it because it was so stark. But now I haven't been able to dig that out or not, but whether that is, that follows. Ultimately, if you're not walking your dog very much, that dog's going to put on a few pounds.
There was a burst of activity in research on dog walking about 5 years ago, maybe 10 years ago now, where having a dog was, and I'm sure the trend is still true, but not many people seem to be studying it anymore. Having a dog was extremely beneficial. It got people walking. There's no doubt about it. Now, which members of the family walk it is another question. And of course, it goes back to our wonderful, you know, history of Per Olaf Ostrand or Ostrand, you know, who always said that, didn't he? You know, always take your dog for a walk, even if you haven't got one. That was the most wonderful phrase I ever heard. He was such a wonderful presenter. And so there, I mean, to put a sort of academic hat on to explain this, there is your sort of environmental prompt.
Yes.
You have a dog and the dogs have to be walked. You can't just, unless you've got a massive farm, you can't just let them loose. You go for a walk, and it's a wonderful prompt. And Neil was probably right. Even if it wasn't backed up by science, it was at the time, you know, it's probably just a bit of a guess, but it was a good guess. Yeah.
Mm. Wonderful. Look, I mean, it's so interesting to hear your big insights. What's left for you? What's driving you? What are you working on that you want to work on before you hang up your I don't know what you hang up with if you're a physical activity psychologist, maybe I don't know, an RPE chart.
Well, it's a good question. I've moved from full-time to part-time. I work part-time now. I'm nearly 70, and I could hang up my boots or whatever the metaphorical equivalent is. I enjoy doing what I do, and I supervise students. I got one working on mental health and green space and blue space in Australia. I've always enjoyed supervising. We have a grant with another university on trying to get a better understanding of how to set goals for physical activity. We've got one of my colleagues who's leading this has got some nice ideas that challenge rather traditional views about goal setting. So that's quite practical and important theoretically as well. I'll just keep doing this stuff as and when. I still do a lot of stuff on sedentary behavior, screen use in young children now. Right. We've done a lot of interviews with parents because screens have changed a lot. It's not just TV and computers now. It's all, obviously, we know it's the mobile devices and even watches and so on. So I'm still very interested in that because that stemmed out of my interest in sedentary lifestyles, too much TV viewing, too much screen use, whatever. But now it's become much broader. What are the positives and negatives beyond just the physical? Is it, problematic for development, social connections, academic work, and so on? So that still interests me. So I'm keeping, and then one final thing, perhaps I should say, and I've been writing a textbook, Psychology of Physical Activity, ever since the 1990s, and we're planning to continue that into a fifth edition, maybe in the next few years, alongside a volume that's much more practical. How do we apply this psychology? So I think that's enough to keep me going and alongside visits to the golf course.
Still at the forefront and evolving because the world is evolving. Is that the textbook with Nanette Muttry?
Yeah, exactly. Ah, yeah, Nanette, yeah. So Nanette's now retired, still active, of course, in many ways. And Trish Gawley and Guy Faulkner have been co-authors, and we'll see over the next year or so how we'll take that forward. But that's been a big sort of passion of mine over the years.
Amazing. Well, look, Stuart, thank you so much for talking to me today. Just a privilege to hear you unpack, but simplify and open up some of these areas with real consideration. Such a stellar career with an incredible contribution to the field. So it's been humbling to chat to you today.
Well, it's very kind of you, Steve. I really appreciate the invitation. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Really have. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for taking the time to listen. I really hope you enjoyed this week's conversation. Now, we've got plenty more to come. So if you'd like to support and champion us, then take the time to subscribe and leave a review on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, or wherever you tune in. You can also give us a follow on Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. All the links are in the show notes. So in the meantime, have a great week.